It just may be that in my view, he's not the right man for the court at this time.
In a vote to push Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court nomination to a final vote, Senator Murkowski is the lone Republican to say no. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, October 5th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, the Trump administration drops some Alaska seafood products from its China tariff list.
Some of that product that will now not be tariffed is product of our competitors, so it's not a straight win.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court advanced one crucial step this morning, but without the help of Senator Lisa Murkowski. She cast the lone Republican no vote on ending debate to proceed to a final vote on confirmation. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports Murkowski found Kavanaugh's angry demeanor at a Senate hearing last week to be a black mark against him.
Murkowski took to the Senate floor Friday evening to explain her vote. She said the bar is extremely high for a Supreme Court justice. Even if he's accused of attempted rape, as he was last week, Murkowski says Kavanaugh needs to follow the rules and display proper judicial temperament.
Even in these situations, the standard is that a judge must act at all times in a manner that promotes public confidence in the independence, integrity, and partiality of the judiciary and shall avoid impropriety and the appearance of impropriety.
The vote was 51-49, so Murkowski's no wasn't decisive. Kavanaugh is very close now to confirmation. Two senators who seemed on the fence, Susan Collins and Joe Manchin, say they will confirm. But outside Murkowski's D.C. office shortly after the morning vote, a few dozen Alaskans who oppose Kavanaugh were celebrating their senior senator.
Thank you to Senator Murkowski. Stay strong. Alaska's behind you, and we're going to keep fighting until Kavanaugh is out. Thank you, everyone.
150 or more Alaskans have flown to Washington in recent days to lobby Murkowski in person, many of them sponsored by the American Civil Liberties Union. There are so many that Murkowski has met with them in her office in groups of 18.
Half of the women in our meeting had been raped or sexually assaulted.
Diana Rhodes of Anchorage had one of the mass appointments.
It was so powerful. Everyone was crying. She was so strong, Lisa, and she said, the weight, I feel like I've sunk 6 feet from the weight of your testimony, of your stories.
Many of the Alaskans told Murkowski it would put a cloud over the Supreme Court to elevate a man accused of attempted rape to that bench. They said it would tell victims what happened to them means nothing. Murkowski says she didn't make up her mind until she walked into the Senate chamber for the vote. She said last week she found Kavanaugh's initial accuser, Christine Blasey Ford, very credible. But she's not condemning Kavanaugh's character.
I believe that Brett Kavanaugh is a good man. I believe he is a good man. It just may be that in my view, he's not the right man for the court at this time.
She says she's been wrestling with competing values, doing right by the nominee versus the perceived fairness of Congress and the courts.
But I value and respect where my colleagues have come down from and their support for the judge. But I also think that we're at a place where we need to be thinking again about the credibility and the integrity of our institutions.
She says it's bad for the country if people who are victims feel the system lacks fairness. Final vote on Kavanaugh is likely to come Saturday. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
In many ways, the three-way race to be Alaska's governor is complicated for voters. But it's also keeping campaign strategists busy as they try to clear a path to victory for their candidates. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman talked with political experts who are keeping tabs on the race.
Elections with two candidates are simple, but in Alaska's governor's race, there are three major candidates: Independent Governor Bill Walker, Democratic former U.S. Senator Mark Begich, and Republican former State Senator Mike Dunleavy. And while three is only one more than two, for political strategists, that extra candidate makes things a lot more complicated. Jim Lotzfeldt is an Anchorage political consultant who has worked with Democrats and other left-of-center politicians. He says it's a challenge for campaigns that want to go on the attack.
When you're candidate A and you attack candidate B, imagine it's like giving them an electronic zap, and some of those voters clinging to them fall off after they get zapped. And in a two-person race, those voters don't have anywhere to go but back to the person doing the zapping.
For Walker, any strategy that appeals to voters on the left or right sides of his coalition risks alienating those on the other side. He says his administration has been able to do what it sees as right for Alaska because it hasn't had to cater to the political parties. Here's a Walker ad with pipefitter Brandon McGuire.
When I look at Governor Walker, I see somebody who is going to make the tough decisions versus somebody who's worrying about their next campaign.
But a group backing Walker, Unite Alaska, is more combative. It has started criticizing Dunleavy in its ads.
When you vote for governor, will you choose a leader or a quitter? When Alaska needed it most, Governor Walker made the tough decisions. Mike Dunleavy? He quit the Senate, abandoned his constituents, and left others to do the hard work.
One group supporting Walker is the Alaska AFL-CIO, a labor federation. Joelle Hall is its political director. She says these ads will make Alaskans aware of Dunleavy's positions.
These are just perspectives and worldviews that the majority of Alaskans just don't hold. They view them as really, really extreme. And once people kind of figure this out, I just don't think they're going to think that he's, you know, not standing so tall anymore.
The strategy's been a little different for Mark Begich. Jim Lotzfeldt, who's worked with Begich in the past, says this year has seen Begich unleashed.
Begich is pounding away on choice and women's right to choose. And then the governor, who is pro-life, comes out and says, I'm pro-life, but my administration's kind of pro-choice. It's all fine. Why does he do that? Mark Begich.
Begich has made a straightforward appeal to Democrats and the political left.
I'm the only candidate who will protect the PFD and school funding in the state constitution, taking them out of the hands of politicians.
But Joelle Hall says Begich's stance won't appeal to Alaskans who are currently backing Dunleavy.
Mark has really tacked to the left, and so maybe that's not where most Alaskans are comfortable. Most Alaskans are kind of in the middle. So I think when they come off Dunleavy, they go to the governor.
4 years ago, Walker and Begich appealed to many of the same voters, but they were running for different offices. While Walker won, Begich lost re-election to the U.S. Senate. Now, they're fighting for the same voters for the same office. John Wood is advising the group Dunleavy for Alaska. He anticipates groups on the left will try to pressure either Walker or Begich to endorse the other, depending on their poll numbers.
The strategy is to try and get the public perception that one or the other, Begich or Walker, is pulling away from the other person, and that if they don't narrow it down to one of the two of them against Dunleavy, they'll both lose.
One sign of Dunleavy's campaign strength is the large early lead for Republicans in requests for absentee ballots. By the end of September, there were nearly six times as many Republican requests as Democratic. 4 years ago, that ratio was 2-1. John Wood says Dunleavy for Alaska has been effective at delivering its message, including the colorful campaign signs throughout the state.
It did it in probably the most professional manner that Alaska campaigns have ever seen up to date.
Dunleavy's campaign has also benefited from funding from the Republican Governors Association through the group Families for Alaska's Future. Its ads have sharply criticized the Walker administration's performance, including this one.
Alaska's economy is last in the nation. Unemployment is nearly twice the national average. It's time for a change.
Another sign that the campaign strategies of Dunleavy and the groups backing him are working is poll results. He had a 15-point lead in results released last week by Alaska Survey Research. Begich was second, 6 points ahead of Walker. Libertarian candidate Billy Toyan wasn't included in the poll. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the impact a renowned radio host had in helping preserve native languages.
You should be proud. You should be proud to hear little Chupik, little Makoyak, little upriver.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com.
Some of Alaska's seafood industry has escaped the Trump administration's trade war with China for now. Some in the industry are happy the administration dropped some mainstay seafood products from a list of tariffs. The Trump administration levied billions of dollars worth of tariffs on the world's second largest economy last week. The tariffs start at 10% and will ratchet up to 25% by 2019. The Trump administration's original list of levies included seafood products that Alaska processors export to China for reprocessing. But Pacific cod, salmon, and pollock products have been dropped from the list. Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute Executive Director Alexa Tonkovich agrees the final list is an improvement. However, she says other countries that send their salmon, cod, and pollock harvest to China will be better able to compete with those same products originating in Alaska because they're commingled upon export.
Some of that product that will now not be tariffed is product of our competitors, so it's not a straight win, but generally we're pleased with the modification and the removal of certain product codes of Alaska seafood off the list. Certainly salmon is a big win, having that off the list.
China has kept its relationship with the Alaska seafood industry in mind during the dispute. It exempted seafood entering the country for reprocessing when it implemented a 25% tariff on U.S. seafood earlier this year. The state harvests 60% of all seafood in the U.S., which accounts for a significant portion of seafood products that are exported to China. The former owner of the state's largest newspaper has reached a settlement in a federal bankruptcy case. As Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, the deal comes just over a year after a tumultuous fiscal situation left the paper's future in doubt.
Although the bankruptcy case was technically brought against the Alaska Dispatch News, in reality, the business was wholly owned by Alice Rogoff, who's named throughout the settlement. The court-appointed administrator looked into whether Rogoff should be held personally liable for debts and if she could be considered a creditor, given that she's put nearly $17 million of her own money into the business and lost all of it. On that last question, the settlement says no. Under the deal, she'll pay $1.5 million by 2020, which will ultimately go to her creditors. Those include telecommunications firm GCI, which has a $3.4 million claim, as well as two local contractors who say they're owed almost $4 million. Much of the $1.5 million is set to come from Rogoff's former husband, financier David Rubenstein, who agreed to direct a portion of payments due to Rogoff from a divorce settlement to companies she's agreeing to pay. Court officials will decide what portion of the $1.5 million will be paid out to creditors. A lawyer representing a local contractor with an unpaid claim declined to comment on the settlement. Rogoff bought the Anchorage Daily News in 2014, merging it with the Alaska Dispatch in a deal worth $34 million. By 2017, a number of different lawsuits made clear the business was in dire financial shape. After filing for bankruptcy, the paper was bought by the Binkley family from Fairbanks for $1 million, a deal that was approved last September. Another lawsuit against Rogoff by former Dispatch owner Tony Hopfinger is set to go to trial next month. The case centers on claims that Rogoff owes Hopfinger almost $1 million, as laid out in a contract inked on the back of a cocktail napkin. Rogoff did not respond to requests for comment. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Katmai National Park's fourth annual Fat Bear Week has returned to, as the park's announcement put it, determine which gluttonous giant sits atop the brown bear oligarchy of obesity. Bears in the March Madness-style bracket are advancing toward a championship next week with votes from fans online. Many watch Katmai's Bear Cam at explore.org and know the Bears by number or name. And as I think Katmai National Park's Andrew Lavelle will explain to me, there's no fat shaming going on here. Andrew, welcome.
Hi.
Why do we care how fat a bear gets? I mean, shouldn't we be encouraging the bears to be healthier, or does fattiness mean happiness for bears?
There's no pushing them to eat more salad here. A fat bear is a sign of a successful bear. And these bears will lose up to one-third of their body mass over the course of the winter, and they will be hibernating for up to 6 months. And so they need to get as much body fat on their bodies as possible. And so it's really something to celebrate in the bear world. All our bears seem to be doing pretty well in the Brooks Camp area of Katmai. This is a pretty good place. If you are going to be a bear, this is a great place to be one. The sockeye salmon runs have been very large the past 2 years out of Bristol Bay, and so all of our bears do seem to be doing pretty well.
So when did voting start, and how is the competition going so far?
This year's Fat Bear Week started on October 3rd, which was Wednesday, and it is off to a pretty exciting start. And it will all culminate on Tuesday, which is October 9th, Fat Bear Tuesday, in which we will crown the fattest bear of 2018. We've had some surprises so far. We've had Bear 409 absolutely dominate the competition so far. She is a sow who has really packed on the pounds after emancipating some cubs earlier this summer. And we have a couple other bears coming up soon, including Bear 747, which people have compared to a Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade balloon. And we have Bear 435, nicknamed Holly, who is a crowd favorite as well.
You mentioned a sow with two cubs who had emancipated those cubs. What does that mean?
Yeah, so sows, female bears, will keep their cubs for about 2.5 years. And at about 2.5 years old, she will give them the boot. She'll kick them out. And we had one bear in particular, Bear 409, who had a set of two pretty large cubs at the start of the season, and she emancipated them, I believe, in late May or early June. So she only has to worry about feeding herself, and she's been quite successful at that this fall.
So I hear you using the number for the bears, but I've also seen names kind of attached to those bears, like human names. And, you know, I wonder about how people feel about anthropomorphizing them. And are there concerns about that? Do you hear from people with those concerns?
Yeah, it's a very fine line. So only a few bears have nicknames, and they are not official nicknames. We want to generally stray away from nicknames that are too cutesy or too biased one way or the other. As much as we get to know them and we think we know them on the bear cams or streaming them online, they are still wild animals and untamed. And it's important for us to remember that. This is more than entertainment. It is really a way to educate the public on the idea that this is a struggle for survival for these bears.
That's Andrew Lavelle with Katmai National Park talking about Fat Bear Week. Thanks for being here.
Great to be with you.
Voting is underway at the Katmai National Park Facebook page, and the Bear Cam is available at explore.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK from Alaska News Nightly. I'm Wesley Early. This week on AK, celebrating Indigenous history. As the ink dries on Governor Bill Walker's signature on the Alaska Native Linguistic Emergency Administrative Order, Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott has been discussing what the order can do and took a moment to recognize KYUK's John Active and his contributions to keeping language alive in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. KYUK's Christine Trudeau has more.
Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott says it all started back in 2014 when Alaska officially recognized its 21 indigenous languages, including Yupik. That paved the way for the legislative resolution passed in April, urging the governor to declare a linguistic emergency for Alaska's native languages.
The governor received it, agrees fully with the reasoning behind it, and signed in Juneau an administrative order, which itself has the force of law.
That instruction stands until another governor overturns it, adds Malott. The order says that the state must do all that it can to preserve and support language revitalization efforts.
All state agencies, all departments of the state of Alaska should work with Alaska Native tribes on a government-to-government basis, recognizing the sovereignty of those tribes.
The Department of Education and Early Development is the lead agency in responding to the emergency, says Malott, and each officer of the governor's cabinet will need to designate a point person. State signs will also change.
For the names of public places, major streets and throughways, and marine signage and aviation signage should recognize and reflect Alaska Native languages.
The Alaska Native Language Preservation and Advisory Council will continue to play a role in making specific recommendations to the governor. Malott says the administration will continue to work to find additional resources to protect and revitalize Alaska's indigenous languages.
The state is prepared to work with the legislature to do whatever is fiscally responsible to meet this emergency.
Unlike other native languages in Alaska, the Yupik language is spoken on a regular basis. One of the advocates for the language worked for decades at KYUK. Before he died this summer, John Active did everything from reporting to reading the news in Yupik and telling stories, conducting call-in programs, and talking with elders in Yupik. He helped shape the radio station where local programming was translated and conducted in Yupik because he was passionate about keeping the language vital and saw radio as a tool. Locally, Active made sure listeners heard different dialects of Yupik representing upper and lower Kuskokwim River communities and coastal communities.
You should be proud. You should be proud to hear little Chupik, little Makoyak. Little upriver.
When outsiders came to report or shoot a documentary, Active pushed them to use people from the community as guides to better understand the region and improve reporting in stories and films.
Unfortunately, a lot of times outsiders come to our area and make films, and they miss the whole point about our lives sometimes, the way we live and stuff. They don't understand our culture. They don't know what's appropriate to film sometimes.
The lieutenant governor took time to recognize Active's legacy, pointing also to the Yupik people who worked to get the linguistic emergency officially recognized.
There are many from the Yupik regions who are very active and leaders in the overall development of this administrative order and the recognition that we do have a linguistic emergency. So it is both timely and reminiscent to mention people like John Active.
Long before Active became an elder, he recognized the importance of getting elder interviews on the air and archived. Before he died, he talked about why it was important to record and keep this oral tradition so cultural wisdom and history would not be lost.
The elders don't have anything written down. Their brains are computers. Everything, their knowledge is in their head from remembering back when they were growing up and how they were taught by their parents and elders. So when elders die, all that information that they have in their heads will be lost.
It was the lieutenant governor's first time back at KYUK since John Active died.
He was such an incredible personality, such an incredible teacher of language in his own right, and I miss him very much, and I know we all do.
John Active will also soon be inducted into the Alaska Broadcasters Hall of Fame. In Bethel, I'm Christine Trudeau.
Chris Ho and KYUK reporter Christy Schallenberger contributed to the reporting of this story. Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Steve Henriksen in Juneau. Henriksen is originally from Washington State and has been the curator of collections for the Alaska State Museum since 1988. He will be part of the museum's Indigenous Peoples Day celebration on Monday.
I'll contribute to it by talking about some of the other types of traditional Indigenous watercraft in Alaska. everything from kayaks, umiaks, birch bark canoes, as well as different kinds of dugout canoes from the Northwest Coast. I started working for the National Park Service up here during the summers as a curator at the Sitka National Historical Park. I really was very interested in Alaska Native culture, and the job in Sitka came open, and it was supposed to be a summer job, and like many people, one job led to another, and before you know it, you've been here for 30 years, but that's what happened to me too. Part of my job, and due to my many family and friends among the Tlingit people, I have gotten to go to a lot of different ceremonies over the years, and I was adopted by the Deklawedi clan of Angoon at a potlatch that we all went to in Klukwan. I'm not sure how common it is, but it's something that is taken very seriously, and anyone who is adopted knows that it is a kind of honor, but it also comes with a lot of responsibilities, and it's necessary for you to participate in the clan doings and contribute to the memorial feasts and other ceremonial activities. You know, something that's always struck me is about how it's how Alaska is just one big small town, and how we run into people that we know all the time, and even in distant locations in Europe and in Washington D.C. we've run into people that we know from here. So it's always fun.
Steve Henriksen lives in Juneau. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Christine Trudeau and Kavitha George. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Wesley Early.
That is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Aaron Bolton in Homer, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Amon Swenson. Wesley Early is our producer. I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Did you know there's no safe amount of alcohol to drink while pregnant? But why should this matter if you're not pregnant or not trying to be? Because nearly half of all pregnancies are unplanned. Many women don't know they're pregnant right away. You could get pregnant and expose your baby to alcohol even before you know you're pregnant. If you're having unprotected sex, don't drink. Learn how FASDs impact everyone, even you, at letstalkfasdak.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.